The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2013 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2013. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the internet. To find out more about ACCS, or to order additional conference talks, visit our website at accsedu.org. Look for the Conferences tab. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
Why don't we pray and get started? Thanks for coming. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for this time, for all of the good things we've been hearing. We ask that you would continue to bless those who are looking for help. We ask that you'd give it to them. We ask that you would bless us in this time, that you would enable communication to take place, that I'd be able to communicate clearly, that I'd have something helpful for those who are here. We ask that you would just enable us with your grace to make good use of this time and this place that you've given us. In Jesus' name, amen. So this is a workshop on a course I teach called Senior Theology. It involves reading great books. It involves hopefully passing on a love of learning of these great books. And as we'll see as we go forward here, some real application for our students going into the real world. But just to give you a little bit of introduction, my name's Keith Phillips. I am the headmaster of Schaefer Academy, named after Francis Schaefer in Rochester, Minnesota. Francis Schaefer lived in Rochester at the end of his life. Last several years of his life, his wife Edith continued to live there till around, I think, the year 2000. She just passed away this year and is buried in Rochester. Both of them are. I've been at Schaefer Academy as headmaster for 13 years. Before that, I was the assistant headmaster for 3 years. So I've been there for 16 years of the school's 20 years. We have about 370-some students, started with 78. So if you're in a new school, in 20 years, we've gone from 78 to 370-some students. Growth will happen. Schaefer is located in, as I said, Rochester, Minnesota. It's a town of about 100,000 people. The main employer is the Mayo Clinic, and the next largest employer is one of IBM's branches. The Mayo Clinic's in growth mode. The IBM is in shrinking mode. And so our town's personality is really very much colored by those two institutions. A town of 100,000 people, Mayo Clinic employs about 30,000 people. So IBM, currently it's somewhere under 5,000, but in the past was quite a bit more than that. This course that I'm going to talk to you about, it doesn't have a very creative name. We just call it Senior Theology. The way that this course came to be at our school, we, in earlier years, had a course called Christian Worldview in our religion department. Maybe your schools have a course by that name. We had it for 2 years, actually two separate semesters, a semester in ninth grade and a semester in 10th grade. That was followed by a class called Basic Christian Doctrine, and then in the 11th grade year, then the senior year, the students took a class called Apologetics. After several years of that sequence in our 9th through 12th grade, we came to believe that we really didn't need 9th and 10th grade to cover what we were trying to cover in our Christian worldview class. Christian worldview class basically was a comparative religions class. Here's what Christianity says about various things in the world, and here's what other religions or other worldviews say. And the materials we were using at the time initially kind of led us to believe we needed those 2 years, but we found that with our students, we didn't. We changed materials, etc. But that left a hole. What are we going to do? We thought we should still continue to teach this worldview class at ninth grade. We thought the doctrine was still fitting well at 11th, but where do we put apologetics and what do we do with this new empty spot? We moved apologetics then down to 11th grade and had to come up with something. And at the time, I was, I believe, the headmaster already and one of the religion teachers, and I had to come up with something. And so since we decided to put it in the senior year, we said, well, we'll call it senior theology class, and that way I can make it up as we go along day by day. So you may be wondering, why on earth are we having a session, a workshop about this? I think that the folks that organized the conference believed that many of you are looking for practical advice, practical application for your classroom. We were told, those of us that are presenting workshops, that on average, 70% of the folks who attend this conference and come to these workshops, it's their first or second time to come. And that regularly the feedback that they receive is that the folks really want in these workshops to receive some kind of practical examples. What are other people doing and how are they doing it? And so that's what I'm going to try to do. There'll be little bits of philosophy, little bits of quotes here and there, but most I'm going to tell you how we ended up doing what we're doing, how I developed the course, and how we implement it, and then we'll try to leave time for your questions as we go. So here's what we'll look at in this session. I'll tell you the goals that we developed for the class. The Roman numeral 2 there probably is one of the goals, but I wanted to highlight it, so I've made it its own point here. I want to talk a little bit about the good of amateur pursuits, depending on who you are and what you're asked to teach or develop. This may, I hope, be encouraging to you. I'm teaching this theology class, senior theology class. I have an undergraduate degree in church ministries, so several Bible classes, classes on how to organize Christian ministries, things like that. But I don't have a PhD in theology or in patristics or in scholastics or anything like that. But yet I'm teaching a course that deals with these things. And I'm trying to accomplish something with my students in doing that. And I want to encourage those of you that may have some insecurity about what you're being asked to do, that you probably can do it, especially if you're trying to pass this type of pursuit on to your students, if that's one of the goals. Then I'll tell you the specific methods I use. All that we're talking about here is one example. It's a model. You can take from it, you can reject it, you can do with it as you will, but this is one model, and hopefully some of it will be helpful to you. And then we'll talk about briefly some of the results we've seen. I've been teaching this class for at least 9 years, so I've seen 9 years of students go through. And then hopefully we'll leave some time for questions and answers. So goals for the class. The first goal that when I came upon this hole that we had in our scope and sequence, to use the jargon, right? We have this hole here. What am I going to do with it? Well, we claim to be a classical school. We talk a lot about great books and these great ideas, and we talk about recovering our heritage. And our students were reading a good number of these things, but there's only so much time in the day. The history teachers can only read so many of these great books. The literature teachers can only read so many. And I noticed that some of the ones that were being neglected would fall into this area of theology. And I wanted, for some reason that probably had to do with long years of reading and education, thought this would be a good thing to have our students read some entire, you know, front to back original sources, and to let the authors speak. Again, when I started doing this, I wasn't totally sure that I knew what I was doing or that my desires or directions were valid, but I had the sense that often teachers talk too much in these classes, don't let the author speak. One of the things I started talking to my faculty about then was, you know, on your best day, you're probably not anywhere close to Augustine or Aquinas or Luther, right? Or whoever they happen to be reading in their discipline, Shakespeare or Burke. You're nowhere near their level of genius. As bright as you are, as dedicated as you are, why are you talking more than you're letting the book talk? Why is more time spent with the students listening to you than listening to them. So I wanted to see what I could do to let the students have more time in the material. It helped that I found a couple, or some encouragement, some support for what I was thinking from C.S. Lewis. I had studied a bit of Mortimer Adler in grad school, so I think some of my thinking had come from him, but I, like many, many people at this conference, had read everything I could get my hands on that came from Lewis, and somewhere along the way, I remembered this essay, often referred to as On the Reading of Old Books. You most likely, if you've already read it, found it in God in the Dock, which was a collection of Lewis's essays, but it originally appeared as an introduction to a translation of Athanasius, The Incarnation of the Word of God. And here's what he says when we're thinking about, can we have these high school students, can people really read these original sources, these great books, these authors, and can we give them more time in them? Lewis says, there's a strange idea abroad that in every subject the ancient books should be read only by the professionals, and that the amateur should content himself with the modern books. Thus I found, as a tutor in English literature, that if the average student wants to find out something about Platonism, the very last thing he thinks of doing is to take a translation of Plato off the library shelf and read the Symposium. He'd rather read some dreary modern book 10 times as long, all about isms and influences, and only once in 12 pages telling him what Plato actually said. The error is rather an amiable one, for it springs from humility. The student, or in our case, maybe the teachers, the student, Lewis says, is half afraid to meet one of the great philosophers face to face. He feels himself inadequate and thinks he will not understand him. But if he only knew that the great man, just because of his greatness, is much more intelligible than his modern commentator. The simplest student will be able to understand, if not all, yet a very great deal of what Plato said. But hardly anyone can understand some modern books on Platonism. It has always, therefore, been one of my main endeavors as a teacher to persuade the young that first-hand knowledge is not only more worth acquiring than second-hand knowledge, but is usually much easier and more delightful to acquire. Now, people might say, you know, Lewis, his view of students coming from his own giftedness is off. Right? Can students really pick up Plato and read it and get more than they can from a textbook? Can they really pick up Augustine and Aquinas and Luther and get more from it than they can from a summary in a textbook? But I thought he's also a very smart guy, very wise man. He didn't seem to suffer many delusions. And so let's give this a try. And over these years, I can say it's largely proved to be true, with some qualifications that we'll see, even some of them coming from Lewis himself. So I felt encouraged by that these goals, these first two goals I had, were not completely crazy, not completely unreasonable. Let's read these original sources and let's give the students as much time in the books themselves as possible. Also wanted to help them enjoy this process. Our school, one of its primary goals is to pass on the love of learning. Many of your schools probably have that in their materials as well. We want to teach the students to love learning. Well, we need to be consciously pursuing that. We need to be intentionally pursuing that. Often that gets lost behind several other priorities, rigorous learning and high goals and high standards. And we achieve that and yet don't achieve the love of learning. And we need to be trying to find a way to achieve both. We were encouraged many years ago, listening to several speeches and probably MP3s of Doug Wilson. I'd encourage you to listen to them. I believe the title of one that was most significant in our school is Lower Your Standards, right? Which is surprising to many people to hear that. But the point of lowering the standard was we need to get the students to love the standard. We need to encourage our students to enjoy what they're doing. If we get them to reach a high standard, but they hate it, that's not success. Now, we want to be raising the standard as we can get the students to love it. As high as we can get it with them loving it, we want to do that. But I wanted to make sure as we do this, I think this stuff is great. This stuff is interesting. This has helped me answer questions that I had in life, struggles that I had in life. It'll help them if I don't bury them, if I don't ruin it for them. How can I set the course so that they can enjoy and benefit from this? And wanted to help them benefit from it. Since we're teaching seniors, especially, they're about to, at our school, most of them go off to secular universities. How can I help them benefit from this learning in a way that will help them not only in their academic pursuits at university, but in their lifestyle struggles, in what they'll encounter as they go out from the protection of their parents and their own home church and our school? So these were my four simple beginning goals. But again, I don't have a Master of Divinity. I don't have a PhD in these things. Is this really something that I should undertake? And I, again, had been formed in many different ways by many different teachers and many different things I had read to realize there is a place for experts and for scholars, but there's also a very important place for amateur pursuits if we understand amateur in a certain way. And I was, again, encouraged by reading from C.S. Lewis, but also by just looking in the dictionary and then by thinking about our schools, many of them, and ours does at Schaefer Academy, claims to be trying to teach the liberal arts. Well, what are those liberal arts about? What's the term even mean? And so Lewis said, and this is from the introduction to his book, The Reflection on the Psalms, says, this is not a work of scholarship. I'm no Hebraist, no higher critic, no ancient historian, no archaeologist. I write for the unlearned about things in which I am unlearned myself. If an excuse is needed, and perhaps it is, for writing such a book, my excuse would be something like this. It often happens that two schoolboys can solve difficulties in their work for one another better than the master can. When he took the problem to a master, as we all remember, he was very likely to explain what you understood already, to add a great deal of information which you didn't want, and say nothing at all about the thing that was puzzling you. I've watched this from both sides of the net, for when, as a teacher myself, I've tried to answer questions brought me by pupils, I've sometimes, after a minute, seen that expression settle down on their faces, which assured me that they were suffering exactly the same frustration which I had suffered from my own teachers. The fellow pupil can help more than the master because he knows less. The difficulty we want him to explain is one he has recently met. The expert met it so long ago that he's forgotten. He sees the whole subject by now in such a different light that he cannot conceive what is really troubling the pupil. He sees a dozen other difficulties which ought to be troubling him but aren't. In this book, then, I write as one amateur to another, talking about difficulties I have met or lights I have gained when reading the Psalms, with the hope that this might, at any rate, interest and sometimes even help other inexpert readers. I have not attempted, of course, to cover the subject, even on my own amateurish level. I have stressed and omitted as my own interests led me, and that'll be important as we get to methods as we go forward. But Lewis seemed to think it was okay to talk about things he wasn't an expert on, even though there were things he was an expert on, like medieval literature. He felt it was okay and helpful in a certain way to talk about things where he was pursuing it as an amateur. And I think he meant by amateur something along these first two definitions that you can find in Webster, that the amateur as a devotee or an admirer, or one who engages a pursuit, a study, a science, or a sport as a pastime rather than a profession. And even those of you that are language type people would know this comes from Latin through French, from the word amo, love. This is the pursuit of someone who loves something. So Lewis thought it was okay to do it. Language backs us up. And if we think about liberal arts, the liberal arts aren't the left-wing arts. They're the arts for the free people, right? These were the skills and the tools, the abilities that over time we Western folks have thought were needed and would enrich the life of someone who was free. Now, this isn't the place to debate, are we free anymore? Are we not free anymore? We don't have time for that, but we're at least a little bit free. We have a lot of money, even though maybe it's not worth what we think it's worth. We're all here, right? I flew down here from Minnesota, been eating in nice restaurants, sleeping in a fancy room. You know, we've got a lot of money compared to many people around the world today and over history. What do we do with this freedom? Do we just watch more TV? Do we just eat more food? What do we do with it? And these amateur pursuits would enable us, I think, the highest ideals of liberal arts are to make good use of your leisure time. A free man has leisure time. A free woman has leisure time. Are you going to make good use of it or bad use of it? And so I wanted not only to take some comfort in my role as a teacher, that I could do this as an amateur, in a sense, in this field, but I actually wanted to pass on to my students this idea that you can read and dig into and participate in and enjoy things as amateur pursuits. I wanted them to see that and experience that a little bit with some guidance as well. So how did we go about doing it? How did our school go about setting this up? How have I gone about doing this in my class? Well, we'll look really quickly here, I hope, at how did we decide, how did I decide what books to read? What kind of a schedule did I set up for the students for their reading? What do I do to help them make sense of the book? Even though I agree with Lewis when he says, reading the authors themselves, students, even an average student, can figure out most of it. Can I help them, though, with some of the things maybe they won't be able to figure out in one semester that will enrich this book for, help them enrich the book for themselves? How do we use discussion? What's the importance of discussion in the class? And then how do I go about grading it? So book selection, very quickly. There are many lists of great books available online. If you go out here to the vendors, I'm sure some of them have some that they'll give you or sell you as well. But I think everybody, even in classical schools now, knows how to use the internet, knows how to use Google. Go on and look. I don't exactly remember which list I used when I was trying to figure out what to do. I think it was some list that George Grant published on one of his websites 10, 15 years ago that I had put in a file, and I pulled it out, and it was a starting place. I tried to find that online for this session. I couldn't with certainty find the one I used, but it really doesn't matter, is what I would say to you. Find a list. Make sure it's from some sort of knowledgeable source, and decide what you want to do with that list. I only have a semester, so 18 weeks, and I didn't want to bite off too much for the students. So I knew I wasn't going to be able to do that many books anyway. So I wasn't going to be able to read all the great theology books in one semester if I wanted them to love it. So I decided, this is probably the decision of an amateur. So those of you with more expertise in this area than me, maybe you can tell me later why I was wrong here. But I decided, look, I want to pick the ones that everybody just about that has any level of education would think are the big ones, right? You got to read Augustine, right? Everybody's heard of Thomas Aquinas, but how many people have read him? At least how many Protestant evangelicals have read Thomas Aquinas? And Luther, everybody knows Luther, everybody quotes Luther, everybody uses Luther to win the debate, no matter which side of the debate they're on. So let's read some Luther. And that also enabled me to kind of help the students walk through a bit of church history, which was a hobby of mine, interest of mine. So we were able to look at the patristic era, at the scholastics, and then at the Reformation. That's about all what I found over these years, unless I want to burden the students a great deal with the reading load and risk them not enjoying it. That's about all I could get through. Originally, I also required all of the students to read Thomas A'Kempis, now the honor students read that as extra assignment. So we read Augustine's Confessions, Thomas Aquinas' Compendium. You can sometimes find this, I think if you looked on Amazon, there's a version out there that's called the Shorter Summa, which is a marketing ploy, right? So they think that people read something called shorter in the title, better. And in fact, the translators admit this in the beginning of that book. It's harder to sell something called Compendium than something that's called the Shorter Summa. So, and that is basically Thomas Aquinas' own abridgment of his entire Summa. He died before he finished it, so he was to have three sections, a section on faith, a section on hope, and a section on love. He got through faith, he died halfway through hope, and so that's all we have. But remember, I only have a semester, and I wanted to read the author's original books, and there's no way we're going to read the Summa in its entirety, so that one worked. So you see the amateur way that we're making the decision. And then Luther's On Christian Liberty is about 90 pages with really big type. And so we're going to work our way through that. This flows through, again, as I at least show it to my students, the patristic era, the era that follows the apostles, the scholastic era, the height of the medieval learning. Thomas a Kempis, when we're reading that, we just present that as kind of a between the scholastics and the Reformation, kind of a pre-Reformation type thing to show how Christians kind of go through pendulum swings of emphasizing kind of the heart side, then emphasizing the head side, then trying to come back, seeing Luther try to deal with both of those, and we move on that way. So that's really how I selected the books, and I would encourage you and challenge you and wish you the best to feel free picking however long you have for your class. Pick a few. It doesn't have to be these. These are pretty good. These will work, but there's a whole lot of books that you could pick. We're not trying to cover, again, as Lewis said, we can't cover the whole subject. So are there some you have some more familiarity with? Are there some you're more interested in? Are there some that you might be able to pass on your love of better? Or is there some goals that you can accomplish with your students? That was book selection. Reading schedules. I have my students read about 10 pages a day, 5 days a week. So as we begin each book, I give them a printed schedule. It tells them what pages to read according to a calendar date. Since we're in Minnesota, we sometimes get a lot of snow days. They have to read it even if it's a snow day that way, since I've given them the whole schedule. And 10 pages for our seniors, even for our average, even for our struggling seniors, is not burdensome. In fact, our top students, it's very, very light load. But keep in mind, and again, I'm both a teacher and the headmaster, so I'm trying to model some things for my teachers as well. They have 7 other classes, right? So sometimes teachers tend to think their class is the only class that the students have or the only one that matters. Well, that's not fair. That's not right, right? Another value of our school, another goal of ours is the importance of community, that character develops in community, that Christ built us to be in community. Well, one good character trait in community is you have to realize all of the things that are going on in community. So again, nothing magical or brilliant about this 10 pages a day. In your context, it could be different, but that's what we do. 10 pages a day, 5 days a week. How do we help the students make sense of the book, but yet let the authors themselves speak the most? We, when we get into the books themselves, focus on discussion. And I'll talk about that in just a moment. But with my lectures, I try to give them some background information, historical information, contextual information that they won't be able to grasp fully just from that book. So if you've read the Confessions, you know that Augustine talks about his wrangling with the Manichees, this Gnostic sect. He says enough in there that you can see these Manichees are some strange people, have some what seem very strange beliefs to especially 21st century students. But Why are they called Manichees? Who's this Faustus guy? I can teach them some of those things in the lecture, so that they can appreciate what they're reading in the words themselves. He goes on to talk about the Neoplatonists. He talks about concubines and things that, you know, the context allows them to understand a bit of what's going on, but I can fill in some of that with a few lectures to make it better. But when we talk about historical setting, theological development, I try to tie some things together. Since we're reading Augustine, he was the kind of the end of the patristics. Well, what's the patristics? Who are the patristics? Aquinas is, you know, the crown of the scholastics. What are the scholastics? What are the characteristics of these groups? Why did one transition into the other? How did theology develop? Why did it develop? What were these guys reacting to? If it's not even spelled out in the book, I can give them some of that information. And then what I call very eloquently stuff everybody should know, right? So everybody should know that Monica is Augustine's mother and that she prayed for him, right? It's educated people need to know that. So I tell my students, you're going to see this referred to in other literature and other disciplines. When somebody says, like Monica, you need to know what that is. When someone says, Lord, give me chastity and continence, but not yet, you need to know that that's referring to Augustine himself, right? You need to, these are things everybody ought to know. So I'll point that out to them, even if they don't get it from the reading itself. And then in discussion, though, when we get into the book itself, they're reading 10 pages a day. I want them to be talking about what they're seeing from it. I want them to explain what they're reading. I want them to ask questions about it. I want them to argue about it. Avoid, if you do discussion, I think there's other workshops during this conference on discussion itself, but just a few things I would say about that. Avoid, when you have the discussion or you ask a question, just someone gives you the right answer. At our school, this is quite a challenge. I wouldn't be surprised if it is at yours as well. And they're used to hearing, good job, Billy. You know, all right, I got the right answer. I never say that. I never really accept their answer. I always push back with something. Oh, you think that? Well, then what about this? Or, hey, what do you think, Sally? And try to get them to argue. Not that their answer is necessarily wrong, but often their answers are very shallow. Their first answer, shallow, superficial, and they're trying just to get the gold star, right? They want the teacher's gold star. Well, I don't want them reading this for me. I don't want them reading it for the grade. I want them to actually read it, and I want them, as they discuss it, to be discussing what they've read, not trying to figure out what it takes to get 100 on my test. And work to involve everyone. In the discussion itself, some people will tend to dominate. The ones that dominate often, at our school at least, are good students, often straight-A students, but they many, many times don't necessarily have the greatest insight into the book. Sometimes some of the struggling students have some greater insights if you can draw them out. Many times the struggling students have struggled, whereas the top students have not yet encountered great struggles, and they can see, wow, this guy was going through this, or this was going on in his mind. And the more high-achieving students sometimes not only can learn, but will be surprised to see what these students that struggle more are capable of perceiving in a work. So again, we could have a whole workshop just on discussion, but those are a few things that I cover. And then grading, how do I grade? We have at least one reading quiz per week, sometimes more. These reading quizzes are things that basically the most obvious details from the reading that they've done since the previous quiz. Some of these reading quizzes are just, did you read these pages? And you'll have to decide whether you're okay with that. But again, like Lewis, I don't think it's my job to catch them cheating. It's my job to not encourage them to cheat and to not set up conditions that make it easy to cheat. But I talk to them regularly saying, if you lie, if you cheat in my class, it doesn't hurt me. It hurts you. You haven't done the reading. That means you didn't learn that. and it hurts your relationship with God. So you're not really hurting me or your parents, other than the fact that we love you and we don't like to see you hurt yourself, but you're hurting yourself by doing this. So some of those quizzes are that, have you read these pages? But others are, you know, in this section, we found out Augustine's mother, what was her name, right? So they should have caught that. In this section, he heard who preach? Oh, Ambrose. Okay, who was Ambrose? Well, it said he was the Bishop of Milan or something. Things like that. Drop down to number 4 on my outline there. My previous approach, when I started this, I had classes of just 5 to 10 students, and they wrote an essay each week. And each day, we would read 1 or 2 of the essays together, and that's how I graded them. As I got up to classes of 20 or more, that became difficult. I'd still love to do that. If you have that opportunity, I encourage you to do it. That was great, but I can't get through. Last year I had 27 students. I can't get through that many essays and help them raise the quality of the essays and things. But that was that was my amateur attempt to do what it seemed to me Lewis and his friends had been doing, which was come see me once a week and read your essay to me, and then I'll tell you what to read again for next week. And that was a lot of fun. But currently, with the number of students I have, I don't do that. I give them only 1 test per book. That's, if you were going to teach a class like this at a lower grade level, I wouldn't do that. But I'm dealing with seniors, so I give them 1 test per book. At our school, I'm required then to give a cumulative final exam that's worth 20% of the semester grade. And that's really the extent of the grading. If there are questions about more specifics, I can hopefully answer those during the question and answer time. So we've seen the goals, we've seen the good of amateurishness, we've looked at my methods, the results. The results are many. I get overwhelmingly positive feedback from the students and their parents about this course. The students enjoy it. They don't all enjoy all of it. There are some that don't, you know, love it deeply. And again, that is something I try to model for my teachers. Every student isn't going to love math as their favorite subject. Every student isn't going to love literature as their favorite subject. And every student isn't going to love theology as their favorite subject. And that's not wrong. There are many members to the body. We shouldn't all be doing and loving the same thing. But did they enjoy it at all? Did they love it at all? Did they see a world that they hadn't seen before? Did their horizon get broadened? Or did it get narrowed? And all of my students, over 9 years or so, have enjoyed at least some of it. Some prefer Augustine. He writes very differently than Aquinas. He writes very discursively. It's like his diary, like just here's what happened, and here's what happened, here's what I learned from this. It's a long prayer, actually. Some, especially my engineering-type students, really like Aquinas' systematic approach. Aquinas' book, even though it's shorter, this compendium, it's very much like an encyclopedia. Here we're going to talk about the Trinity, and now we're going to talk about the Godhead, and now we're going to talk about the Incarnation, all these heading points, and some students really love that. They don't necessarily agree with him, but they just like that he writes that way. Some prefer Luther, as Luther's style is the closest, obviously, to modern writing style. The students end up better educated than most people. In fact, you know, I'm sure better educated than most people in most of our churches. And I go to a church that's overwhelmingly high educational level of the members, and many, many of them have never read all 3 of these books. And yet we have seniors that graduate knowing this. And then students are helped with life. They get to see that questions about sexuality, entertainment, peer pressure, education, careers, etc., are not new. They see all of this in Augustine. Augustine liked to party, and he liked entertainment. He liked going to plays. Before he became a committed Christian, he liked going to the gladiator shows. He liked sleeping around. He lived what we would call in today's society, lived with someone in common law kind of marriage. All these things that in the language of the time seem odd to the students, as they read it and we talk about it and discuss it, they come to see, man, this is the same stuff we're dealing with today. Maybe today it's more internet pornography that we're struggling with, but it's the same thing. Peer pressure. Augustine steals pears from a tree. He admits, I don't like pears. I wasn't hungry. I stole them. And actually, it wasn't even peer pressure, although he admits peer pressure played into his life. I just wanted to do it to be autonomous, to be in charge, to do what I wanted to do wrong. So the students are able to see from that, wow, the sin comes from within me because I want to be in charge. I don't want God to be in charge. From Aquinas, they see the value of precision in theology, even when they don't agree. This is where this pushback on them comes. We get to the section in Aquinas on purgatory, and overwhelmingly Protestant evangelical students I have, that's just stupid, And so we get to push back and say, now, wait a second, Aquinas, you really think Aquinas is stupid? Is stupid and wrong the same thing? If you think he's wrong, do you want to figure out how he came to this wrong conclusion? What might have led him to this wrong conclusion? We've got to not just always say something wrong is stupid, and we get to have the opportunity to have those discussions. If you disagree with him, why? Where from the scripture? What logic do you have to argue against it? Here's his logic. Refute his logic. And they see what develops from this precision. And then they see, of course, from Luther, the importance of grace. So this isn't a perfect class. It hasn't on its own and wasn't intended to change the world. But it, I believe, has been a positive for our students. And as I say, over many years have received much positive feedback from it. So I would be glad to take any questions that you have. And do we need a microphone, or can we just speak up? I'll just repeat them. So, yes, sir. Just a second. Yep. Go ahead in the back. Yeah, middle. Yeah.
What kind of theological
instruction did they have up to their senior year? Up to their senior year. So the question was, what type of theological instruction have the students had up to their senior year? In our elementary school, the students go through all of the books of the Old and New Testament one time at that level. So at depending what grade level they're at, but we have a course guidelines for the elementary teachers, and so each book of the Old and New Testament gets covered at least once from first grade through sixth grade. In seventh grade, the students then have a Old Testament survey class. In eighth grade, a New Testament survey class. Then in ninth grade, Christian worldview, where we're reading Sire's book, The Universe Next Door. In 10th grade, it's still basic Christian doctrine, in which we basically study our statement of faith, Schaeffer Academy statement of faith, but we use J.I. Packer's Concise Theology as the textbook. And then in 11th grade, apologetics class, and then this class. Does that answer the question? Yep. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, sir. So the question was, are our students catechized in the shorter catechism? No, Schaeffer Academy is a non-denominational school, so we have students coming from various traditions. We do have our own in-school catechisms, but no one would have followed exactly the Westminster shorter or larger catechism. We use parts of it. We say, the first question we say in chapel regularly and recite back, but some, the students who are from a Presbyterian background, may have been fully catechized in the Westminster, but not all of them. The majority of our students would be middle of the road evangelical people, standard, Billy Graham's a good guy, the Bible is God's word, that type of thing. So, and our school's influence brings a bit of Kuyperianism and, of course, Francis Schaeffer's ideas to them. Yep, follow up. So the question was a list of some other books, a different book by Augustine, and then stay with Aquinas. I'd love to talk with you about that. And, I'm not familiar enough with that other book of Augustine. What was the title again?
Enchiridion.
Yep. To a systematic. Yep. And then going into Westminster, to Calvin.
Yep.
That's great. I'll get those titles from you. But I wouldn't have any objection to that. Some of it will depend on how confessional your school is. So some of our schools here, I know, do openly admit to their parents, look, we're coming from the Westminster Confession, or we're coming from one of the classic Reformed confessions. Our school does not. We have a statement of faith. And so even at our school, we could do that. Yes. Yes. We could still do that. We just haven't, is the answer. So yes, sir. The question was, what am I assessing on the book tests and how is it structured? I'm assessing over half of the tests, maybe even closer to 3/4 of the test, is over kind of the contextual information, the background information that we've covered in the lecture. But then the remainder would be long answers and essays talking about various parts from the book. So some of those questions, though, even are describe and discuss one thing that you agreed with that you learned new. Some of them, the other one would be name and describe one thing you disagreed with. One would be name or describe something that you found illuminating. It made a light go on for you. I'm not giving the exact wording, but I think you get the point. And then sometimes it's, how do you see this fitting into what you've learned in your other courses? How does this fit into Western civilization more broadly? Does this person deserve, or does this work deserve the place of stature it has? Does that answer it? Yeah. Other questions? Yes, sir. So, yeah, so the question was, it sounded like from my description of the quizzes that the quizzes were asking basically grammar level type questions, and we don't get to the deeper things until after the discussion. That would be correct. That's how I'm doing it. I wouldn't necessarily think the other was wrong. The reason I've done that, though, again, keep in mind, one of my goals is to get them to love this material, and a lot of them, just like a lot of Christians in general, feel intimidated by it coming in. And I'm wanting them to see, you can at least figure out what's going on. Another reason is just practical. I'm a super busy headmaster, and I've learned if you can't keep up with the grading, you better not do it. And I would have a hard time keeping up with grading deep. That's why I switched from it. It used to be once a week they had to write a 1-3 page essay on what they had read up to that point, and then we would discuss it, and then I would grade it. As we got to larger numbers and our school grew, I just couldn't keep up with that. So that was a great way to do it, but now it's more a reading check. Are you keeping up? And one of the skills I'm trying to teach them is, if you read 10 pages a day, this won't be a burden. If you wait till the day before the test and you read 300, it will be a burden. I'm trying to help them learn some things I never managed to learn until probably grad school, you know? So, I can see pros and cons either way, but am I answering the question there?
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm getting at.
Okay.
Sometimes, as teachers, mm-hmm. expect them to get a lot more out of the
yep.
material before
yep.
you have a chance to play around with the ideas.
Yes, and the way I'm kind of handling that, the follow-up question was, a lot of times the students actually can get more depth from the material than the grammar level on their own, and I agree with you fully about that. I try to get that out of the discussion, and so I'm asking them questions. The only lecture I give them before they discuss are things that wouldn't have been in the text itself, you know, so kind of just historical context and whatnot. But before I will give them input into what's in the text itself, I've drawn that out in discussion and made them wrestle with it. Sometimes I don't help them find an answer or resolve it. If there's different positions, they drew different things out of it, I'll let them live with that in frustration for a couple days, hoping that they'll work themselves to an answer. So, yes.
Can you describe what the essay prompts would look like for instead of reading quizzes?
The essay prompts when I did, instead of the quiz, it was very, very straightforward and simple. response essay was, you've read it, you need to write something about it for me, right? And then as I went on, I did have to give some more specifics about, you know, I'm going to be grading you on, is it the right length? Does it look like it actually is tied to the book at all? Or did you quote one line from the book and then write, you know, a lot of blather from your own head? Off the top of my head, I would be struggling to give you more specifics, but you can email me and I'd see if I can find some of those. But it was intended to be back then, 9 years ago or so. You guys are reading it. Let's see what you can learn from it. I'll help you, right? And so they would write write to me an essay about what you're reading about. Then they would read it in class. We would all discuss it. And then I would collect it and grade it and say, hey, read this, go back to this part. I think you're right on here, go here and you can find more about that. Or, ooh, I think you're off here, go here. And, you know, and that's the kind of stuff I just don't have time to do. I mean, it's a great thing to do. Do it if you can do it. But I part of what I want to do in this workshop is let you know, you can't do everything, but you can do something. And do that and enjoy it and have a good time with it. Somebody had it. Yes. Yes, sir. So the question was, what feedback do we get from graduates as they go on? And then the question included, with this being the pinnacle of their great book study, this is just kind of one peak in the Alps, maybe, because at the same time they're taking this class, they're also taking a class in Western philosophy. So they're actually reading Plato about the same time we're reading Augustine, and they're reading Aristotle about the same time we're reading Aquinas. And so I have a philosophy teacher that's teaching those. And so this class alone, you know, I would hesitate to say that, you know, it made all the difference, but combined with our other classes, the students generally say that their first year at college, especially in, you know, introduction to Western civilization or whatever they're calling it nowadays, are very easy for them to do. They know all the terms already. They know all the major players. They have at least some context for it, and it's helped them to see, to be prepared to deal with different opinions or evaluations of these characters. So we do spend time in my class and in the Western philosophy class saying, you're going to hear this in the future, or, you know, this used to be a prevailing secular view. Today it's changing to this. What do you think? Again, we don't say, and those people are all idiots, but we try to engage with it that way. So I would say simple short answer is they find it beneficial and helpful. The ones who go to Christian universities say that their you know, Bible classes, religion classes, Western Civ classes are super easy. That, you know, we've more than covered what they get covered in their freshman year. So, does that answer your question, sir?
Go.
Their personal walk? Yeah. Right. So how does it, in general, I would say it affects them positively. Let me just give you one anecdote. One student who in middle school, most of the faculty thought I was crazy for not kicking him out of the school. I got lots of pressure from my faculty and other people saying, this kid and his three or four friends really shouldn't be in our school. And I said, you know, if you're a teacher, you have to believe that people can change. And I do kick kids out. So, I mean, there are times where people can cross a line, but I thought this kid had potential, worked with him, disciplined him pretty intensely. And, right before he got to my class and then through this class, he got in some trouble. He had to come into my class. And he says, I don't remember saying this to him, but he says, Mr. Phillips, what changed my life around was you said, Josh, if you don't get your Ordo Amoris in order, if you don't figure out your Ordo Amoris, your life is going to go to hell. And I don't remember saying that, but I believe him that I said. And this kid now is walking very closely with the Lord, is a godly husband. And so I think it has some impact. It's hard to know how to tell you that other than anecdotes, that the students seem to think that it helped them see that Christianity is something real, not just, for lack of a better term, not just a Sunday school kind of Band-Aid on top of everything, but it's like down into everything. So, yeah. Sorry. So the question was, are the students prepared when they get to this class for the difficulty of the material? And do we do things to help them with it? Most of our students are prepared to handle it by the time they get to 12th grade. When I say that, I really mean most. We have students who really, really struggle, but with our school overall. And when they get there, they can decode the words, right? Most of them, unless they have some sort of real severe reading disability, but generally that's not the case. They can decode the words and they can get the general gist. And one of the things I want them to see is even from that, they're getting something. They're learning something. We don't read summaries. We don't, in this class, we don't use other helps for it other than my lecture and discussion helps. So they'll be getting help from their classmates in the discussion. Think back to the Lewis quote, you know, the other students will be saying, no, it's this, and it's, you know, you misunderstood that, or, oh, no, this does make sense. Some students, this year I had one kid who just thought Aquinas was the greatest thing ever. The rest of the students didn't, because they didn't like his distinctively Catholic-type, Roman Catholic views, and so they have arguments about that, and then I try to interject myself in to be helpful that they aren't falling off the cliffs. But no, I'm wanting them, part of the goal of this class is that they just struggle through it. That struggling through it is the skill I want them to learn. And so some get more than others from it. Sir. So the question was, how does placing this course at the senior year, along with the other courses we had before, accomplish what we want to accomplish with the students theologically and spiritually? I definitely think we could accomplish similar things putting it in a different order, but what we're trying to do is that they would have basic biblical familiarity. So that's the Old New Testament surveys, and that's woven in all our classes in chapel, so that, you know, they know where Genesis is, they know where the Psalms are, they know the main characters of the Bible and the main stories. Then we want them to know how Christianity as a worldview compares to other faiths so that they're prepared to be attacked. We want them to understand where our statement of faith came from, where modern evangelical statements of faith, how they developed. We want them to be able to defend their faith. That's apologetics. As to why this one was in the senior year, it in my opinion, strengthened all of those, right? So these guys quote the scriptures intensely. People think they don't, but Augustine's full of scriptural quotations. Aquinas is full of scriptural quotations. We're going to have to wrap up here, but these solidify that, enhance that, show how real people live that, and they're at an age where they're most able to read the books to good ends, and where I feel the most free. Augustine is pretty frank about stuff that he's doing that's fairly immoral, right? And I think it's a great time for them to hear that. They're going, even if they're going to Christian colleges, actually, but those that aren't going to Christian colleges are going into where it's actually more common to not be chaste than it it is to be, right? And I want them to see, wow, that's actually in many ways not new, and what can be done about it? And so I'm not sure if I'm answering your question. We're wanting them to have basic biblical knowledge, to be able to defend their faith, to be able to understand the history of doctrinal development, and then putting this at the end shows them that how it's happened by the great men. So we're 2 minutes over, but is there any other questions? If not, thanks so much. I hope this was helpful. I think you can do it.